Today, for Always Record episode 154, I am very happy to welcome back Christopher Knowles of The Secret Sun. Krishby, no stranger to our listeners. I hope you're all familiar with his Secret Sun blog. If you're not, familiarize yourself right away. He was also a guest on Always Record episode 61. Bear in mind, Chris Knowles is, aside from his blog, he's also the author of Our Gods Wear Spandex, The Secret History of Comic Book Heroes, The Secret History of Rock and Roll, as well as a topic we're going to be touching on a lot today. He co-authored a book called The Complete X-Files, Behind the Series, the Myths, and the Movies. We spent a lot of time talking about this most recent series or mini-season of X-Files, as well as a number of tangent topics. This was a wonderful, wide-ranging conversation. I'm very happy to share it with you. Thanks so much for joining us. As someone who's been following your work for a long time, it's encouraging to see this almost feels like this year has reinvigorated you. And I don't know how much of that is coincidental or not, but how much of that is sort of inspired by a return of the X-Files, and how does that sort of fit into this? You know, is this how much is it fiction or?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I was very highly ambivalent about the return of the X-Files, and I remain so. It exists sort of on two levels for me. There's the symbolic, semiotic level, and then there's just the basic, narrative storytelling level. And on Christmas Day, they put up a documentary that had clips from the upcoming series, and they had the cast and crew and talking about the upcoming series. And I just remember just getting like sort of like a very queasy feeling. I don't know what I want to say. I felt it, you know, the performances just kind of seemed off to me. It's interesting that, you know, Chris Carter keeps saying that, you know, this is the time for the show to return. And, you know, the world today is like the world that they predicted back when the series was in its prime. But television has changed. The people themselves involved in the show have changed. The audience has changed. I think that there was too much of an effort to try to return to the old formulas. I very much felt that they should have done, you know, very much a single storyline, you know, six episode miniseries that was a single storyline that did tie into all these things that you're talking about, these things that are going on, these things, and you know, tie back to how these things were sort of prophesied in the show originally. So the X-Files itself, I mean, as sort of a harbinger, it's been very interesting in that regard. But I'm almost tempted to regard it like not necessarily as canon. Like I'm not sure I necessarily see it as part of the body of work of the original series. It seems like a strange sort of coda or encore in that regard.
It exists in this new media stage because you also see how it could be not in itself necessarily a reboot, but setting up a reboot. Like they introduced a new cast. And X-Files has already gone down this road where they had Monica Reyes and what's his name, Doggett?
Yeah, John Doggett.
The T-1000.
Yeah, Robert Patrick.
Right, thank you. So you see that they've already tried that once before of, hey, we can have X-Files. And I remember an interview at the time, Chris Carter saying X-Files is the stories and the paranormal cases, etc., not necessarily Scully and Mulder. And so he tried changing out the cast, and you see with this introduction of Agent Einstein and is it Miller, where you see it very possibly you could. I would not be surprised if we saw an X-Files reboot with the two of them. So
Yeah,
it could
well, you know,
exist in. Go ahead. Oh, so, yeah.
no, you finish your thought.
I just want to say it could, in a way, it could exist as not necessarily a reboot in itself, but setting up the reboot. So it's like where it acts as this, coda to the original series and then getting ready to launch a new one or something.
But you know, we've seen that so much. We've seen so many TV shows try to recapture that formula. Most recently, Fringe. But you know, also things like Warehouse 13, that show Threshold. I mean, there have been so many attempts to recapture that magic. But when you talk about those cast changes from the original series, I mean, those were really forced upon the producers. I mean, David Duchovny had decided that he wanted to leave after 7 seasons. They very much did not want him to leave. I mean, they were very upset about it, especially after he sort of forced the show to move to Los Angeles from Vancouver. Which really, I think in a lot of very important ways, took away its mojo. The show was never hot after it moved from Vancouver. You can't, when you create that kind of magic, and I think there's a greater lesson here that goes beyond, even television itself, and certainly beyond the X-Files, is that when something magical happens, when something hits the zeitgeist, there's always an alchemical formula behind it. There's always a magical, combination of elements that you can't quite understand. I mean, you can maybe quantify and identify, but you don't necessarily understand them. And as we've seen with this reboot, I mean, they tried so hard to recapture. They did the show in Vancouver. They tried to get some of the original producers back. They tried to replicate that formula of mythology and standalone. They revisited a lot of the old storylines. They did a lot of visual tributes to sort of iconic moments from the original series. You had David Duchovny, you had Chris Carter, you had some of the other writers and producers, you had certainly Gillian Anderson and everything like that. But it goes to show that that there was also the times that the times were part of the magic, and there was also a very important X factor, a very an X factor that I don't think a lot of people understand or even are aware of that was driving that series then. So when you see these new characters, which was Fox's idea, by the way. And Fox is like, well, maybe we could do the spin-off or do an X-Files Next Generation or something. It sort of got shoehorned into the series, and what that all ended up doing was creating almost a sense of chaos that there was just so much going on. There were so many ideas being implanted, so much symbolism, and this is one of the things that kind of concerns me about Chris Carter, is that he's so invested and so sort of obsessed with symbolism and allegory and double meaning that it kind of, it makes me feel that he's lost that sort of P.T. Barnum instinct you know, that the you know, the story comes first, you know, the give the people what they want, as far as that compelling base narrative. And you know, at the same time, I mean, they tried to do, you know, like the comedy episode, which I just thought was so awful, and so badly executed. I mean, there was probably like a really good script in there somewhere, but the way it was directed and executed, I mean, it looked like a Mad TV skit.
You're talking about the Were-Wizard?
Yeah.
Because I just as an observer, that episode, I agree with you. The direction was there was a lot of talking heads and like the where was the camera? Like
It looked
where
like
was
it looks like it was shot on an iPhone.
yes. Which actually. I mean, let's go there because that actually would not surprise me if that was an intentional decision. It would not surprise me,
Well,
but
there is an important point here is that, you know, the X-Files in its original incarnation was shot on film.
yeah.
This incarnation was shot on digital video. And digital video and film are two entirely separate mediums. You know, one
Absolutely.
is electronic and one is chemical. And this might begin to sound pretentious, but I still very much believe in this sort of alchemical magic of film. That film has a quality, an essence, you know, even when it's at its worst, you know, that there's still some sense of magic, you know, the way these salts and these chemicals sort of cohere into these images, that these cold, sterile electrons can't necessarily replicate.
It goes way beyond aesthetic. Yes, there's something real. I was a as a I was obsessed with the Twilight Zone growing up. Probably like my birthday's New Year's Eve, so they always did the
Oh
Twilight
yeah.
Zone
Oh,
marathon,
absolutely.
right?
I'm with you all the way. I mean, hardcore,
Right.
absolutely.
So that was sort of like that's my foundation. And you would always occasionally get that one episode that would pop up that you're like, what am I looking at? And then you realize
The
that
video episode, yeah.
exactly, right? And
Yeah.
I think they did, I want to say four or five of those, but they stand out, like they just pop off the
Like
screen as
sore
some,
thumbs.
yeah.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the classic example in my mind of such a stark difference where it looks, quote unquote, more like there's more depth in the sense of it almost seems like the characters are more real, but the movements are exaggerated. It actually makes the acting seem worse. There's all these just different psychological changes that go into it, aside from what you're talking about, which, for people in our sort of crowd, I mean, yeah, there might actually be a legitimate, magical aspect of the alchemical process of developing film.
Oh, I feel that there is. I mean, it sounds ridiculous and pretentious and the kind of thing that, you know, you kind of almost wince when you read about it in sort of an academic journal. But it's one of these things that when you see it play out and you see the difference in something as stark as, well, here's a great example. I mean, a lot of people will dismiss the final season of the X-Files and I'll defend it. I mean, I think that there were a lot of great episodes. I mean, I certainly see that it was problematic, that there were a lot of difficulties they were having because they were operating under the whole shadow of 9/11 and they were working, you know, basically for Rupert Murdoch. So, I mean, they were constantly second guessing themselves as to how far they could push this narrative. I mean, and it's interesting, you know, because it sort of seemed to trigger this response in Chris Carter where, you know, the stories that he was writing were, you know, even more extreme, you know, almost di well, not even almost, I mean, didactic, that they seemed almost, not almost again. I mean, they were screeds. I mean, the whole thing with which is actually prophetic now. There was an episode called Trust No One, which talked about NSA, you know, surveillance, the kind of thing that became very, you know, much a household word with Edward Snowden. I mean, the X-Files did in 2002. So, you know, that sort of prophetic instinct that the show had cut its teeth on was operative there. And, you know, and it's almost like this instinct that Carter has to sort of double down. We saw that sort of this series, you know, where he's really pushing these very strident and didactic, you know, anti-government, anti-New World Order narratives, you know, in the context of the X-Files mythology. I mean, this stuff had always been there. You always had characters using this rhetoric, you know, from the very early seasons. You always had this kind of through line with these rhetoric taken from the conspiracy underground was being mainstreamed through the X-Files. But here, I mean, it was on steroids. It was, you know, it would make Alex Jones blush.
Yeah, I think this is why I understand your frustration, because the Chris Carter episodes in particular seem like almost like a sense of urgency. Like, all right, if I get 6 episodes, I'm shoving as much of this stuff out onto the airwaves as possible. But then you also paradoxically take these long breaks to explore, hey, let's joke around with some reptiles. Like, was this...
Yeah, well, it was like a sense of whiplash. I mean, that's kind of, you know, I said that before this, you know, after the first episode. And I'll tell you something, I guess my main brief with the series is that it was just a mistake to return to the format that they had when they had 20 or 25 episodes to branch out and to, you know, tell some conspiracy stories and then lighten the load a bit with these lighter comedy episodes. But in this sense, you know, you started off where Carter is like a rocket, and he's jam-packing that first episode with all this information. I mean, these characters, you know, are essentially speechifying, because he has all this information that he's been processing, that he's been obviously stewing about, that he wants to... you know, basically unleash on, you know, these poor X-Files fans who just, you know, a lot of them who just want to see this whole Mulder-Scully relationship unfold. And he's using, you know, that platform to mainstream, you know, some rather extreme rhetoric and theorizing. So it seemed to me that he had a storyline that could have very easily gone 6 episodes. That first and last episode, you know, there was enough story. There were enough plot points to tell a 6-episode story. And it all sort of got condensed and compressed into these 2 episodes. And you sort of felt... like what's going on? I mean, there's too much information being thrown at you. There's too much happening all at once, and you know, you wanted it to sort of breathe. You know, that television today is serialized, it's decompressed. You know, it plays out almost more in real time. That these stories feel more like real life because they're not you know, it's not compressed storytelling anymore. It's not like Law and Order where, you know, a crime is committed and then it goes to trial, you know, in 45 minutes. I mean, that's just not the way television works anymore. And when you have to jam pack what I call fan service, where, you know, the online fans and the, you know, the online fans who become critics need to be sort of mollified with, you know, the comedy episodes and, you know, the stuff with Mulder dancing and you know, all the relationship material, you know, all that is fan service. There was so much attention being paid to keeping, you know, those sort of hardcore vocal fans happy, that it pushed, you know, it pushed the what I think he wanted, the story he wanted to tell, into the margins. And you know, it just felt, I don't know, it just...
Well, can I throw you a here's my question, because what I did notice, and I'm going to be, you know, blunt with you, is I watched the first few seasons of X-Files when they came out. I remember, it's sort of odd memory to me, and I was speaking to my friend Douglas from 42 Minutes about this when the X-Files came back. Both of us have memories of it was a family affair. Like, it's the last show I can remember where the family sat down to watch the show together in, you know, in the living room.
Oh, it was appointment TV. I mean,
Yeah. And, you know, I would say I probably broke with X-Files probably just, like, if I was logical about it, probably just because I was, you know, in high school. At some point, I didn't want to be home on a Friday night with my family. It was probably why I broke with the X-Files, not because it was uninteresting. But I would really only watch the first few seasons. And, you know, I would sort of... After I would, you know, check in occasionally. I still enjoyed the show, but I am in no way a scholar or even, I would say, a super fan. But something caught my attention in this, because, I mean, there was just this confluence of factors that seemed interesting to me with this relaunch. And then, as, I don't know if it's as the outsider or what, but or as the sink head watching it, what I noticed, and it seemed very intentional, is that we have the bookend episodes, and then you have the four middle standalone monsters of the week. But particularly those four episodes, they seem like fractals, essentially. They are standalones, yes, but they all harp on the same symbolism. It's repeated in each of those four that I think, and again, maybe this is bad from a P.T. Barnum sense, but from a symbolic writing perspective, I understood that those episodes were not quote-unquote standalone, that they were reinforcing the symbolism and the narrative of the message that they were trying to convey.
Well, that brings me to my other point.
Please, yeah.
Yeah, is that I totally agree with you, and that's how I appreciated, you know, the relaunch, is that I was working on the symbolism, which was really dense and really thick and incredibly esoteric. I mean, more esoteric and more compacted and more explicit. You know, the esotericism in the series was always implicit, was, you know, it's something that I spent a lot of time decoding and parsing, and I think most fans were oblivious to. But basically, you know, I was watching these episodes over and over again and picking out these narrative strands because they kept repeating themselves. And I was familiar with, say, the entheogen theory. I was familiar with the mythology, particularly the mystery cult mythology. I was familiar with, you know, ancient astronaut theory and things like that. All these strands, esoteric thought that they're encoding into the stories, I was very familiar with. So I was able to parse all of this throughout the series, and that became sort of the launching point for a lot of the work that I've done. I mean, sort of my big debut in a synchromystic sense, I guess you would say, came in 2004 when I did this huge exegesis on how the last three seasons of X-Files were really following the what's called the Delta Cycle of Egyptian mythology, you know, what we know as the classic Isis, Horus, Set, Osiris, you know, that whole mystery cycle, how it was following it almost to the letter. I mean, it was obsessive. And I went through all these myths. I was reading these myths in their original form and showing how it paralleled all these plot points in this myth arc in the last three seasons of the X-Files in such a way that it just couldn't have been, you know, some vague Joseph Campbell's hero's myth kind of thing. It was definitely intentional. And, you know, I later came to realize, you know, Chris Carter recently had a series that he tried to launch on Amazon called The After, where he basically was trying to do this exact thing that he did with the Delta Cycle with Dante's Inferno. He wanted to do a sort of post-apocalyptic series based on Dante's Inferno, where each episode would be based on one of the cantos. So I guess there would be 100 or 99 episodes. I mean, incredibly ambitious. But this is just the way he thinks. Everything, you know, is sort of allegory. I mean, the second X-Files movie was based on a Houston Smith a lecture, you know, and the book that Houston Smith was promoting at the time was based on his experiences with entheogens. You know what I'm saying? So I was pulling all this stuff together, you know, over the years and doing a lot of this stuff on the blog on The Secret Sun. And then they do this episode, Babylon, which is, you know, basically a mystery cult narrative. I mean, it's the classic, I mean, the quintessential, I mean, the absolute quintessence of the mystery cults, which is descending to the underworld to speak with the dead. I mean, he even has Mulder on Charon's boat. I mean, he has the smoking man playing that part, you know. It was just so incredibly explicit, you know, in the whole thing with the mushroom trip and everything like that. I just couldn't believe it. I was like, oh my God, it's like, I felt like that episode was produced basically for me. It's like, yeah, you're right. You know, all these crazy theories that you've been writing about are true. This is exactly what we've been doing, for, you know, the past however many years.
And let's go to your theories, because so we know that those middle episodes were reordered, if that's the appropriate way to say it. Like, they were originally going to be released in a different order, but yes, by putting the mushroom trip episode as essentially the last of the standalones just before this alien contact one, it goes back to an idea that you've been writing about for, I don't know how many years, but a long freaking time, that you would have this some sort of hallucinogenic, entheogenic episode followed by an alien contact episode. Like, they would always be paired and on screen unrelated, but that you would always have them sort of touching each other back to back.
Yeah, and that started in the second season with two episodes. One was called Red Museum, and it itself, you know, it was about kids being injected with alien DNA, which sort of shows up in this series. But it was laden with, you know, with mushroom symbolism. I mean, this cult sort of dressed like Amanita mushrooms. They, you know, they wear these white robes and these red caps, and you know, they walk around looking like mushrooms. It was really kind of funny. And their leader is called Odin, and that sort of ties back to these theories that Odin was basically a mushroom. You know what I'm saying? that Odin appeared in Norse mythology through these shamanic journeys that were inspired by Amanita. So But And there was also things with like scopolamine and stuff like that in that episode. But that was paired with this episode called Excelsis Die, which took place in a nursing home. And there was this, I guess he was Malaysian, this Malaysian shaman who was working as a janitor, who was giving these Alzheimer's patients this, you know, giving them magic mushrooms, and they were all sort of recovering from their Alzheimer's. So it's like, but they did that throughout the series. I mean, the most explicit example of that is when they did they finally got around to doing their Quatermass in the Pit tribute, Biogenesis. And that was directly preceded by an episode called Field Trip, where Mulder and Scully are trapped in this giant, you know, underground hallucinogenic mushroom. So.
I'm so glad you brought up, if it's pronounced Quatermass.
Quatermass, yeah.
So it's spelled Quartermass, right?
It's actually spelled Quatermass. Yeah.
Is it? Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I've seen you write about this movie, again, for years. I've seen you point to it, but I've enjoyed your, I've enjoyed your writing. I'll read your X-Files episodes, even if it's about an episode I've never seen. I just enjoy sort of looking the way you think and stuff like that. So I've seen you write about this movie, and I just never got around to watching it. But something recently, when the X-Files relaunched, Mike Quellen and I got into a conversation on Facebook about it, and I was just like, all right, then now is the time I'm going to watch this.
Did you watch the movie or the miniseries?
I watched the movie, is it 1968 movie, I believe it is?
Yeah, it's a great movie.
It was incredible. But now the synchronicities or symbolism of a lot of what we see in this relaunched season was explicit. And the reason I believe that Quater Quarter is because there was this continued focus, this unresolved focus on a quarter, right? Scully's mom's quarter.
Yeah. And well, that's like a pun.
Right. And then there's even in the Trash Man episode, they start off talking about the horses like being drawn and quartered. He's like, oh, the limb's being ripped apart. And he's like, oh, well, the horses, he says, but it's about being drawn and quartered. So there was this sort of quarter pun gets used a few times.
Well, that's exactly what I'm talking about. I mean,
right,
it's
like deep hat tip to what, I'm not exactly sure. I just want to throw you two more real quick to say. You have in the Founder's Mutation, the telekinesis, right, which we see in that movie as well. In the Babylon episode, they hook up he puts this skull cap thing so that they can read his brain waves, right? They want to see inside his dreams,
exactly,
or his brain waves, exactly,
yeah,
from that movie.
Uh-huh.
But then there's a step outside. This, one of the things I'd like to address is that the X-Files launched following the Super Bowl, which is fascinating, primetime spotlight, right?
Right.
Well, what did we see in this year's Super Bowl was that big stage with that Flower of Life design.
Yes, which, yeah, from the Coldplay album, yeah.
Which, in Quatermass in the Pit, inside that ship.
Oh, that's incredible. I didn't
even
think of that. Yeah, that's right.
And it's fucking weird because I'm watching and the guy goes, that's a pentagon. And the guy goes, what? And he goes, a pentagon. It's this Kabbalistic symbol. I'm like, that's not a pentagon. Like, I'm watching this going, did he just say pentagon? But regardless, having watched it right after the Super Bowl.
I think he said pentagram, but yeah. Yeah, no, that's incredible.
Right?
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah.
It was like this weird sigil thrown onto the screen, ushering in like the again, I'm not implying intentionality, but it was bizarre.
Did you notice the whole thing with the sigil magic in the last episode?
Yeah.
I was like, I saw that, and I'm like, you know, this is why I think there was something unhinged about this series. Like, there really was. There was something manic about it. And that's why I said it sort of exists on two levels for me. It's like, you know, just as far as entertainment, you know, I have like a lot of issues with it on that level. But the symbolism and the, you know, the semiotics and the synchronicities are just off the charts. It's just incredible. And it almost makes me feel like I get this very strange feeling that he doesn't care anymore. Like he doesn't care about entertainment. Like it's, that's not what it's about to him anymore. That it is like this kind of, I don't even know how to describe it. A working, some kind of exercise, you know, because on one hand you have all the, you know, the extreme rhetoric talking about the surveillance state and, you know, the depopulation agenda and all these sort of things that, you know, I know he's been, you know, he says he's been very concerned about it. He's very worried about, you know, this whole agenda unfolding. And at the same time, I mean, is this some sort of protective magic? Is this some sort of, I don't know. I forget who I was talking to, but I saying that I felt like the producers and the writers all got together and like went on some sort of vision quest and like tripped on mushrooms for days before they wrote these stories, because that's how they all kind of feel like that to me. I mean, even that comedy episode, you know, it's basically about reptilians. It's the whole reptilian mythology that we saw just recently with this Kyle Odom. I mean, that's the other crazy thing is that not long after the series is over, we have this X-File story come to life with this guy out in Idaho shooting this pastor. And that, you know, that story, he's replaying two X-File storylines. He's playing Folie à Deux from the fifth season, you know, which is another one of these, you know, hallucinogenic storylines. And then also a story from the eighth season where this guy hops the White House fence to warn the president that the aliens are taking over. I mean, was this guy just like a really hardcore X-Files fan or what? I mean, his whole cosmology seemed very influenced by David Icke. But like I said, it just seemed like this manifestation, like he almost seemed to me like a tulpa from that was drawn up from, you know, the energies that were put forth in front of millions of people with this X-Files series. But there really was something like very unhinged. And in a strange way, I mean, it did tie into the zeitgeist again. You know, like there was this whole, you know, the whole rap on X-Files back in the 90s is that how it tapped into the zeitgeist. You know, it was a zeitgeist defining television. And that was a sort of a time where things were a little, you know, it's the 90s started off with a recession and the war. And things were a little tense. And then you also had things like Ruby Ridge and Waco, and you had a sort of a spate of school shootings as well. I mean, things were, got a little paranoid there. But as the 90s progressed, I mean, it was, you know, it was Fat City. I mean, you had the stock market boom, you had the tech boom. Things were very, it was like the halcyon days. And I think that, you know, as the times changed and things sort of turned against it, you know, the show sort of faltered. But the second movie, you know, which really got a very bad rap with critics and a lot of fans didn't like, which I just don't understand. But it very much tapped into the whole zeitgeist of the late Bush era. You know, this it was very bleak and cold, and it just depicted a world in which the people who were supposed to take care of us just didn't care. It was, I thought it was, you know, a very apt reflection of what's, you know, continuing to go on in our society, and maybe had its genesis in that period. But, you know, this sort of unhinged, go for broke feeling that I got from these stories, you know, it does tap into this zeitgeist of 2016, which is just, you know, I mean, things are just going crazy. I mean, the entire world is just, I don't know. It's, you know, we do feel like we're on the cusp of a breakdown almost. You know, it almost feels like, you know, the world feels like, you know, these old, you know, old TV movies of, you know, the housewife on the verge of a nervous breakdown kind of TV movies, you know, this whole subgenre. You know, the world sort of feels like, you know, like we're replaying that, we're playing out that that storyline. And 2000, you know, when you talk about 2016, you know, I mean, what, you know, what did it start with? It started, you know, with losing an icon, you know, not only of music, but also of cinema and magic, and ufology. I mean, yeah, you know, this, and sexuality. I mean, you had this figure who became sort of this defining zeitgeist unto himself, who I couldn't imagine life without, you know, and he died on my mother's birthday, which was just kind of a disorienting experience. So yeah, I mean, 2016, I mean, I remember reading on some fringe sites that people saying like 2016 is like the real 2012. And it's funny that they refer to that in that last episode of the X-Files, that, you know, the process began in 2012 and it's unfolding in 2016. And oh my God, that seems like a pretty apt diagnosis of what's going on in the world right now. At least it does to me. I don't know how it feels like to you.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's in this two notes,
you know,
there.
I mean, we see what's going on in Syria, and Syria, really, one of the things that people don't realize about Syria is that Syria is sort of a pivot point for much greater forces at work, and two of which are the fact that the two large Sunni powers in the area, namely Turkey and Saudi Arabia, are both facing these existential crises. Turkey is trying to basically, you know, reestablish the Ottoman Empire, and Saudi Arabia is trying to, you know, establish itself as, you know, the unchallenged ruler of the Islamic world, and sees, you know, Iran, Syria, Iraq, you know, as an intolerable affront, and that's kind of what you're seeing. I mean, this whole idea that there was a civil war in Syria is really a media creation. It's part of this greater confluence of struggles between these regional powers. But, you know, that's created the migrant crisis in Europe. That in turn is unleashing the far right, which in turn is, you know, causing destabilization in the Baltics, which in turn is causing destabilization in Scandinavia. Russia is kind of eyeing Sweden and seeing it as sort of an intolerable threat to its security. I just read that Russia is talking about that if North Korea doesn't get its act together, that they're going to be bombed. I mean, you know, everything now is at, you know, the tension is just constantly being ratcheted up. You know, we're seeing, you know, we saw what happened in Chicago with the Donald Trump rally, which I believe was an intentional provocation on his part. And I think he's going to continue to do that because, you know, it helps him.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you think he didn't know that if he held a rally in a college in Chicago that there were going to be problems? Of course he knew that. I mean, that was...
And I had seen it pointed out that his stops before that were St. Louis and Baltimore. Like,
yeah.
That it was a sort of like intentional, like, let me poke and prod areas where I know I'm not going to, where I'm probably not going to be welcome or where there's already tension and see if I can make something boil over. And then I get headlines and then I can say, you see, this is why we need to be even tougher. And it's such a strongman tactic and it's hard.
It's a very dangerous provocation that, you know, threatens to unleash civil violence in the United States, you know, of a kind that we haven't seen in this country for nearly 50 years.
I'm not going to lie. The Trump thing makes me so fucking nervous. Like, it's...
I still have a hard time just taking it seriously, but it's
I did up until recently, and you know, dealing with conspiracy parapolitics, like, I feel like I've been fully aware that we're in a sort of fascist, you know, ideological movement for some time. We saw it with Bush, etc. You know, we sort of like danced around these terms and analogies, but there's something about seeing people right now where they're not hiding their language is, I think that's the scary part for me. Where, like, you know, we talk about the thing with the X-Files. Yeah, it wasn't like really a great, it wasn't great television, but the symbolism and the, like, the stuff under the surface was so fascinating. This is like the opposite, where it's like the thing that's bubbled up from the surface is all the poisonous thing that was hidden under there, and it's like, I almost feel like I can't pretend anymore. I do want to get into Trump.
I don't want to get into that. I thought it was just, what I'm just trying to say is that, you know, the X-Files actually did tap into the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, it tapped into this unhinged, manic, conflicted, you know, wildly contradictory, paranoid, in not in a sexy kind of
right.
70s conspiracy movie sense, but in, you know, off the meds kind of sense, you know, that it actually did tap into the zeitgeist. And I think what people want to see now, and what people talk about when they talk about what they like to see on television, is they want to see escapism. You know, they want to see their fantasies played out. Because when they see their fantasies played out on television, they can pretend that they're real. You know, they can begin to visualize them, and they can carry those visions, you know, through their daily lives with them, and sort of see them as a sense of comfort. And that's why, you know, people go online and you know, discuss these shows and place such great importance in these fictional storylines, because the storylines that they focus on are really expressions of their fantasy fulfillment for how they want the world to actually, you know, play out. Or in the case of, you know, The Walking Dead, it is, you know, a horror show, obviously, but it's so absurd and over the top that it's comforting in that regard. You know, I mean, that's always been horror's function, is to allow us to escape our real life anxieties and project them onto these fictional narratives. And I think what Carter did, and why I think what he did was so upsetting to people, is that he didn't let people escape that. He made people confront, you know, their real anxieties. And I think that's something that you really can't get away with anymore. You don't see that on television. And it's something I was really struck by watching the commercials. You know, how this world that exists on television commercials just seems so unrecognizable from the real world. It's creating this you know, this utopian vision that just doesn't exist anywhere. And everything is this sort of, you know, happy face, singy-songy world now in these commercials. And you know, I think they have sort of a narcotic effect that they tend to numb people. And yeah, you know, it's a kind of, I'm not exactly sure how to put this, but you know, even the commercials themselves are, you know, are an escapist form of entertainment, you know, rather than simple advertisement. You know, there's definitely been a shift in the purpose and the goals of advertising, you know, that in many ways was always there. But what I'm saying is that it's become very pronounced, you know, very, you know, hypertextualized is, I guess, the term I'm looking for.
Absolutely. Well, can I ask, while we're on the subject of back on television, I want to ask you specifically about something. You and other people have pointed out the connections between X-Files and Twin Peaks, right? That they share a lot of the cast members and
Yeah,
things like
and you're
that.
yeah.
And this is also coming back, so we have
Yes.
another possible relaunch. Just a real quick question on this note before we go into that. Did you notice in the Werewizard episode inside the hotel when the guy smashes the mirror, he's talking to it, is very much almost the exact same shot as the last shot of the Twin Peaks season finale, season
Yeah,
two?
I didn't pick up on the parallel there, because I just, my jaw was just agape throughout that whole episode. You know, it's very interesting, because that script was actually repurposed from, it was originally written for the, there was a relaunch of Kolchak the Night Stalker that one of the X-Files executive producers was involved in. I think it was back in 2005. And the writer of that episode, who sort of pioneered the X-Files comedy episode, Darren Morgan, had originally written that episode for Night Stalker. But my theory is that that was originally itself, he was supposed to have written an episode for the fourth season of X-Files, but he never finished it. So I think that that was Night Stalker, script that was repurposed from an X-Files script. So I was just like, I can still see that he's very clever with dialogue and stuff, but I almost felt there was, I thought there was like a lot of anger in that script, and I felt that he was I like I felt a lot of self-loathing
Oh,
in that.
but yeah, I think that's explicit in it. Yeah.
Like, and the fact that he's using his characters to express that was upsetting to me, because when I see that in people who've been, rich and successful in Hollywood, I don't have a tremendous amount of sympathy for them. I know that, success breeds its own problems and stuff like that, but you can afford therapy. The self-loathing, it almost, it didn't almost, it really veered into pathos, into self-pity, and I just had a really hard time identifying with that. But I do know that, he's the kind of guy that, he very much subscribes to this whole sort of materialistic, reductionistic, skeptical mindset, sort of a Dawkinized, Randiite worldview. And I'll tell you something. I mean, I wish I could say that that kind of thinking doesn't, isn't the end of that road, but I see it all too often, that you end up in a very big, very bleak place when you subscribe to that kind of thinking, because really what that kind of thinking begins as is that I'm smarter than everyone else. And you hear that in some of his director's commentaries from the DVDs in the original series. He sort of badmouths other writers and stuff, and and then where does it end up? It ends up, in that episode, and it's just so weird because all these people were saying, "Oh, that episode is so great and everything," and I'm just so baffled by it.
Can I throw you one quick thing about that? So, like, there was the, there's the one. I think one of the things that at least people in the more fringe, our corner of the internet focused in on, right, was the possibilities of was the character, the were-wizard, was he meant to be Kolchak? Was he meant to be Tracy Twyman had this gentleman that she proposed that it was, which was a very,
Nicholas Devere.
yeah,
Yeah,
very
Nicholas
interesting
Devere.
article.
I actually found that I found her arguments like pretty persuasive, and that would suit, like, Darren Morgan has written a lot of great episodes. I mean, especially his Millennium episode. He did a spoof on Scientology that I thought was fantastic, called Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense. And if you ever get a chance to check that out, it's an amazing episode, and probably the best takedown of Scientology that you'll see. But yeah, I mean, he did a lot. He would do a lot of deep research. His UFO episode, he was obviously reading Messengers of Deception. He was reading some interesting material that he incorporated into the script. So I would definitely not be surprised if he knew of that whole thing with Nicholas Devere and the Dragon Court, and then took that, subsequently into the whole theory with David Icke and the reptiles and everything. But that, and the interesting thing is that if that's so, that, verifies my theory that this was originally an X-Files script from 1997, because those memes, were really current at that time.
There's another aspect of this that I just want to point out to you. Will Morgan, the other co-host from 42 Minutes, he pointed out to me like a few days after that episode aired. He's a kind of sink head that'll go to like IMDb and look at some of the background actors, whatever. The guy who plays the Werewizard doesn't have a huge acting career. What he does have is he was in something. Shit, I can pull up the name of it, but basically he played a werewolf that was coming, that basically the a werewolf that would become a human and that was like upset with the human condition. It was like basically he already did this story. That same actor already did this story, except he was a wolf, not a wizard. And that to me, again, it plays on this, in one respect, plays on the idea of almost like a meta narrative that it's all of these things at once or so insanely self-referential, Russian doll type references. And at the same time, it also goes back to the idea, like, as you say, this is a story that we've, it's like an old canned story that we just sort of pulled out.
Yeah, well, but that's like my feelings about the relaunch in a nutshell, you know? Like I am fascinated by the deep background on that episode, you know? I mean, I thought it was really fascinating that he was drawing on these fringe theories and the and that connection that you refer to there, that's, you know, that's interesting, you know, in that meta text, you know, sense that. But I felt that there was so much of that going on in the series. I mean, you know, here's a perfect example. I mean, when Founder's Mutation, which was supposed to be the fifth episode,
And
and
that was
probably
the
would,
best, man. That was.
yeah, that probably would have made more sense if it was, because it, you probably would have understood the last episode better if that was fresher in your memory. But anyhow, that entire episode was basically bullet points from episodes previously and sort of iconic shots. It's almost like somebody made a collage
Or a
of,
quiz show.
yeah, like a clip show, and then wrote a narrative around it. Because so much of what we saw in the in that story was referencing other episodes. And the strange thing about it is that the writer who worked on that, a lot of the episodes that he's referencing were episodes that ran a long time after he left the show. So I was kind of confused by that. I was thinking, you know, why is he referencing that episode? That, you know, that was from the eighth season. He left in the fourth season. I was having a hard time sort of wrapping my brain around that. But that was, again, very much characteristic of what was defining this series, is that it was all meta. It was incredibly meta. You know, I mean, it's like that show, Founder's Mutation, had a surface narrative that it was about this doctor who was experimenting on his own children, with alien DNA, which ties back to, I mean, goes back all the way to Erlenmeyer Flask and to Red Museum, other episodes from the first and second season. But what that episode really is about is that it's about the X-Files itself, because so much of it is, you know, it's self-tribute. You know, you've seen how directors and movie makers will pay tribute to their influences by recreating shots, you know, icon, you know, particularly iconic shots, from a director like Kubrick or somebody like that, and they'll pay tribute to that in their own films. You know, that's basically what he's doing in that
But
episode,
using his own show.
but not even using his own show. I mean, he's using other writers from the X-Files. So I was like, that was a real head scratcher to me. I just couldn't understand. Like, I couldn't understand why exactly he was doing that. And the trash monster episode, the Band-Aid Man episode, that was basically a mashup of two separate episodes, one of which that writer was involved in, an episode called One Breath, which is the episode when Gillian Anderson returns to the show from her pregnancy. And in the storyline, Scully returns from her abduction. And then an episode that ran in the sixth season, which was also about a tulpa that was created from trash and garbage. So I couldn't, you know, and that to me was like, he didn't watch the show. You know, there were two separate impulses at work here. The first guy seemed like he was paying tribute to the show itself. The second guy seemed like he just wasn't paying any attention to the show at all, that he was just, writing this story that was a rewrite of an earlier episode. And everybody was sort of like, wait a minute, they already did that storyline. It was just, it's like such a specific storyline. I mean, maybe it was intentional, you know, maybe in the context of this relaunch, it was intentional, but what a strange thing to do.
Right. That's what's fascinating.
You know, like a tulpa made of trash. I mean, what does that mean? You know, you can understand that in the greater context of the series, all these, you know, drawing parallels to all these storylines about alien DNA being experimented on humans, blah, blah, blah. You know, that all kind of makes sense. But, you know, where did that come from? And that's,
in my opinion, and again, you're the expert on the X-Files, but I just want to throw you for what it's worth, as a little bit of an outsider view on this. What it seems to me is the things that we have in which is the episode? Is it Founder's Mutation, which he references the monolith, quote unquote monomyth, right? They make reference to that, sort of alluding to the idea that this is all fucking meta thought going into this. But as what I noticed in every one of those standalones was a really, like, each one had a specific, like, hit the nail on the head referencing Adam, Garden of Eden, stuff like that. And it's that trash monster. It almost seems like the point of that is that he's showing that he's a man made out of clay, right?
Yeah.
And in that respect,
you're right. In that regard, it does make sense.
Because it's almost, and my guess would be if you're going to the storyline you lay out of in the season finale, Scully is actually meant to create this vaccine, is meant to give this out. It's, I don't know if this is like an allusion to like the forbidden apple or something like that, where, right, she's the one who's going to give it to everyone. But I mean, you have the trash can man made out of clay. You have the episode Cold Babylon referencing Eden. There was something else in that one as well. You have in Founder's Mutation, the boy named Adam, who she says, oh, you've been here forever. You have no parents. Your name is Adam. All this sort of shit. And then there was in the Werewizard one, there's he wakes up. And he's,
every 10,000 years.
But he says, the guy says, I woke up. And for some reason realized that I was naked and I had never thought of it before. Like, he wakes up and is aware of his nudity, and they shoot him almost as if he's in the Garden of Eden with like a flower, with a plant in front of his genitals. So again,
yeah,
there's a
exactly.
reference there. And so I don't know what they were going for there, but it was these sort of like nods and repeated symbols.
See, this ties back again to Founder's Mutation, meant to be sort of the penultimate episode, where you have Planet of the Apes, and you have not only Planet of the Apes, but you have Escape from the Planet of the Apes, which is sort of like this, you know, eternal return.
The apes in spacesuits.
Yeah, and it's like this feedback loop. You know, that the apes in spacesuits are going to recreate the world in their own image, which is, again, very meta. But this whole thing with the monolith, that's what I'm saying. It's like I really feel like these guys all got together and like went up to the Sierras or something and just like tripped balls for days and wrote down all this crazy shit. And then decided to just jam as much as they possibly could into these stories. You know, and like I said, this whole thing with the mystery religions, it's like, okay, you know, you've speculated on this for however many years. Here it is, as explicit as we can possibly make it. You know, the whole name dropping of Madame Blavatsky and things like
Yeah,
that.
yeah, yeah. And I was happy to see, on a personal level, I was happy to see during that mystery religion boat, because I thought the mushroom scene actually was a real turnoff for me. The over the top like country music throwaway. Why did the lone gunman get reduced down to like 2 seconds of screen time in a bar that they weren't even? I don't know.
Well, you know what that's from? See,
It's another reference.
that's
It's apparently it's a music video.
no, but you know, see, that's the thing, is that the storyline is referencing a real life event that took place in Garland, Texas, that this right wing group was holding this Draw Muhammad Day exhibit, and there was an attack. On there were two gunmen showed up, two heavily armed gunmen showed up, who claimed, and eventually ISIS or whatever that group is actually called, took responsibility for the attack. You know, but they were involved in this shootout with police officers, you know, SWAT team, and they were both killed. So that's sort of the genesis of that whole storyline. It was based on this real life event, and you know what I posit in the and the reason the Blavatsky reference is made, because interestingly enough, I mean, Blavatsky did not actually believe that spiritualists were speaking with the dead, so that story, I mean, that name dropping there doesn't actually make sense in the context of the story. It seems like there's another, you know, it's another clue. And what I argued is that the whole point of that story is that it's actually about ISIS, that there's this ISIS cell, and the whole reference to Babylon is that, you know, where is ISIS from? You know, what does ISIS mean? It means the Islamic State of, you know, Iraq and Syria. Where is, you know, Iraq, you know, Iraq
It's
takes us
Babylon,
back to
right?
Babylon.
And
You know what I'm
ISIS,
saying?
absolutely.
And the whole thing goes about, you know, and the Blavatsky thing, what's her first book is ISIS Unveiled. And the whole thing
Right.
was about unveiling this ISIS. And it's like this is the thing, like it almost worries me that Chris Carter's thinking is so fractal. That it kind of leaves a lot of the audience behind, because he's just operating. It's like he's almost like playing sort of three-dimensional chess with these stories. And I think a lot of people just don't get. I also think there was a lot of network interference with
Oh, for
that
sure,
show.
yeah.
Yeah,
Like
I
Ford
think.
ads and all that sort of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, well, first of all, after the first episode, I just taped, I DVR'd them and watched them without the
Oh, I
commercials.
meant the Ford product placement. Like if
Oh, absolutely.
like
That
how
was.
like the final episode begins with a shot of from inside this car as Scully's
Huge shot. Oh,
closing.
yeah.
Right, it
Oh.
looks like a everything looks like a car commercial. Whenever you see a car on the screen, it looks like the image, the aesthetic changes for about 30 seconds into a car commercial,
I
but
know. See, that's another thing that I just found so intrusive.
wait, before we go there, you got back around to Syria and ISIS and this sort of thing.
So anyway, so
I
yeah,
want
just.
to just zero in. Do you remember you wrote a blog post? I just remember the name of it. Calendar Not Your Own.
Yes.
Okay. And to me, this is really important in the particularly in the frame of say getting on air and saying oh about New World Order and blah blah blah. Like this has become mainstream. But what it also has done is has reduced the thinking down to like there is a singular master plan. Everything that's done is according to a whatever they want to call it, satanic,
A
thelemic,
cabal, yeah.
right? It's their ritual. It's their ritual. But the idea that you drove home in that blog post was the idea that, hey, there are other calendars and there are other rituals. And I don't know if that.
I think, yeah, that whole thinking of a singular monolithic conspiracy and a singular monolithic cabal comes from Christian fundamentalism. I mean, it really is an outgrowth of, the idea that Satan has a plan. Satan has is in charge of all this, that he's driving all this, and his lieutenants, are the Illuminati, the New World Order, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's people will drift away from fundamentalism, but the conditioning remains intact. I do not believe that. I don't know a serious conspiracy researcher, a serious conspiracy researcher who's very much,
Serious.
who's very concerned about like the same things that other conspiracy researchers are, and more so as well, that believe in this whole idea of, monolithic power blocks. I think the real situation is that there are competing power blocks and competing agendas and competing conspiracies, and that I think is far more dangerous, because that opens the door for catastrophe. It's almost I feel like this whole idea of a monolithic conspiracy is like almost comforting. It's like, well, things will get really bad, but it will be a police state, but there'll only be like a certain, we'll still get our food and we'll still be housed and we'll just be spied on and all this kind of stuff. It's almost like a stopgap conspiracy agenda or scenario. I think that the more troubling agenda or scenario is that all these competing power blocks could just completely destroy the entire system and destroy the entire world and leave us in like this, what Gordon calls this Cormac McCarthy the road scenario. We're all basically reduced to survivors foraging for scraps of food.
Right, caught in the crossfire there.
I mean,
Can I ask how you juxtap?
or even just like flat out nuclear annihilation.
Fuck,
I
yeah.
mean, you know what I'm saying? I
You
mean,
think of
that's,
Planet of the Apes. I mean, when what upset me
or
most,
worse,
right?
I mean, or just, reduced to the planet reduced to Mars level extinction. I
Right,
mean,
right. I only just bring up Planet of the Apes to say whatever. That's an. I was just gonna say when in was it 2001? I think when they made that remake, Tim Burton made the remake. He changed the ending. He said, "I remember this drove me crazy at the time." He said that he didn't think nuclear annihilation was really a concern anymore. That's why he changed the ending. And I was like, "Are you fucking kidding me?" But anyway, I want to qu sort of
well, it
ask.
wasn't, maybe it wasn't a concern that seemed salient to the audience at the
Right.
time.
But I think what you're the point nonetheless is that we have the potential, whether it's again what you someone wants to attribute it to climate change, the way you talked about the toxicity of our environment, basically we have the capacity and seeming desire to kill ourselves as a species and a planet. So
Well, that's, this is the thing. It's like, to the, I always had a problem with the 2012, predictions. But at the same time, afterwards, a couple years out from 2012, I kind of had second thoughts. I was kind of like, well,
What did something happen there?
It just seemed like a lot of trends, or even a lot of sort of what I would call mechanisms, started to unfold, started, you know, like a machine started humming to life, let's say. Let's use that as our metaphor. Like a machine, like, you know, the world didn't blow up in December 2012, but a machine, a doomsday machine, if you will, seemed to shake off the cobwebs and start to hum to life. Because if you look at the world before that period and you look at the world since, you know, things have really begun to spiral since then. And you know, we're constantly hearing about how things are getting better, and you know, the economy is, you know, maybe getting worse for certain people, but other people are enjoying the benefits of, you know, modern capitalist society and cultures that were once immersed in you know, absolute squalor and poverty. And that is true in one sense, but there are a much deeper levels of concern. You know, let's leave aside the environmental issues. I mean, what concerns me is that we seem to have seen what's called the Great Game of Nations make a major comeback in the past 4 years. The Great Game of Nations being the old game of empires, and you know, if you get your information from American media, you won't necessarily get an understanding of this. But you know, if you know the United States just ordered a major naval fleet to the South China Sea,
largest ever military exercise off the coast of Korea.
Yeah, you know, we had that major war games in Korea. Sweden is very concerned that Russia is going to take it out because of NATO encroachment. You know, Turkey is threatening to destabilize all of Europe, and as well as the Middle East. This whole situation in Syria could well trigger. I mean, Syria could be like literally the next Serbia. You know how Serbia and triggered World War One, you know, the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, just sort of unleashing this entire process. You know, it's interesting because last time when I was on Always Record with you guys, you know, I had said that after the superstorm, Sandy, you know, the next day we walked around and I was looking at, you know, my idyllic suburban neighborhood, and it looked like Berlin after, you know, the fall. Mm. And you just realize how provisional things are, that the things are very temporary. And I think that people just don't have a sense of how provisional and temporary, you know, civilized order can be. And I think you have, you know, again, people like Donald Trump who are just poking at the hornet's nest, and he's not alone. I mean, there are people, look at all this agitation on college campuses and things like that, where they want to do away with the First Amendment and things like that.
Oh, sure, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not restricted by any means to a single ideology or partisan group. It's all over the place.
You perfectly just brought together a few of these ideas that I'd like to sort of see if they come together in just one head. So we have the serious. We have the idea that you say there's not a monolithic cabal, let's say, that there's a bunch of disparate warring ideologies and empires. I'm curious, how does this, I don't know, how does this stand juxtaposed to something you've pointed out over the last few election cycles, the stairway to Sirius, this repeated symbolism, this commonality of symbolism that we see almost all the things that we could see, the fractured different pieces. Oh, this is kind of like, I didn't mean for it to go this way, but kind of like how the X-Files episodes or whatever, how they kind of are different broken pieces, but they are almost like have a holographic, each one contains the whole type deal. I'm just curious, as we see this election cycle going, I know you didn't really want to talk about Trump. I don't even want to fucking think about it, but I'm curious how the Stairway to Sirius symbolism still plays out, and what do you think at this point that kind of is pointing to or is quote unquote means?
That's really a very good question, because when I was on Gordon White's podcast and I was talking about what I call the elite cargo cult, and I think that the Stairway to Sirius is part of that. That I think if you look at the origins of that symbolism, the Stairway to Sirius symbolism, that it comes from certain versions of the Masonic tracing board, which is, you have this blazing Sirius, the blazing star of Sirius, and then you have this, what's often seen as a winding staircase, but a staircase with these angelic beings descending from the heavens, descending from Sirius, and often coming to a podium at the bottom of the staircase where there's the Masonic checkerboard and everything like that. Or more accurately, a chessboard. I think that there are belief systems at work that we can only see glimmers of, that we're not necessarily getting the whole of. And one of the things I've been talking about lately is how, our history is incomplete. After the Iraq War, there was the looting of the Iraqi National Museum, where thousands of Sumerian scrolls were stolen, very methodically and very deliberately. And they've made a lot of noise in the media that, oh, we've recovered this material, but in reality, two-thirds of the scrolls are still missing. Why was somebody interested in Sumerian scrolls? Why would that possibly be of value? Do you understand what I'm saying? You have ISIS making a big show of destroying sites like Nimrud and Petra. Not Petra. Was it Palmyra? Destroying these archaeological sites. But as it turns out, a lot of the statuary that they're destroying are replicas, are actually plaster replicas. And what they're actually doing is hoarding and reselling a lot of this material. So at the same time, they actually are engaging in actual destruction. It's all part of this process to drive up the cost of these historical documents that they're selling on the black market. And as I documented on the blog, I mean, this has been going on for a long time. I mean, what's the fascination with this material? We can only guess at it, but there's definitely, like I said, I can only call it a cargo cult. And another thing I recently wrote about on the blog, it's all these, when you said at the beginning of the discussion here, all these themes that I've been following over the years are all sort of reemerging this year. I mean, one of the things that I had been following for a number of years was Dubai. And interestingly enough, on New Year's Eve this year, 2015, 2016, there was actually a major fire that actually looked like terrorists, like a bombing, but was very quickly hushed up in the media. But now they're announcing that they're building a hermetically sealed domed city within Dubai itself. And I'm thinking, why would they possibly do that? But they did that. They announced this like literally weeks after the existence of that transplutonian planet was finally revealed. So just think about the timing, you know, what people in the fringe and alternative communities have identified as Nibiru, you know, once called Planet X, now called Planet Nine, was finally confirmed by legitimate astronomers. And just a couple of weeks later, you know, Dubai, this bizarre, completely inexplicable sci-fi city in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of a sand strip in the Persian Gulf, announces that they're going to be building this. You know, what they made special care to let everyone know was a hermetically sealed domed city.
Right, in one sense, it's like a survival arc or something, and then...
Well, it doesn't even make sense as that. It's like, why, you know, it's...
But the symbolism of it, Dubai, you have like the tallest building and then this dome, it's like goes back to that serious dome obelisk repetition,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. It's you know, it's we can only speculate. We can only speculate, and the speculation usually takes us to places
Oh
that are...
my God, were you implying, okay, since Dubai, like, they have all these things can only be seen from outer space, are you implying, like, as something comes close, the return of the old ones, perhaps, that they would be basically making something big enough that these beings could see it?
Well, that seems to be the implication.
Right?
I mean,
Okay, yeah, that just clicked in place for me. Yeah, I get that.
yeah, I
I
mean,
fucking get that. Okay, wow.
But you know, the whole connection with this, but that's like you said, and I pointed out on the blog as well, that's encoded into the Sirius glyph itself.
Right.
You know, so we can, like I said, we can only speculate on this stuff, and what other people believe may not necessarily be the truth. And I always take special care to point that
Oh,
out
yeah.
when I write this stuff. And just because they believe this doesn't necessarily mean it's true. But the fact that they do believe it, that they seem to signal their belief in these things in their symbolism, is certainly, you know, should give people pause.
Do you want to believe?
Well, it's interesting. I want to know, you know,
Right.
Like that's like belief to me is, you know, I one of the reasons that I stopped being a Christian and going to church is that, you know, belief kind of was very frustrating to me. It was a, you know, it was sort of an incomplete circle. You know, I found Gnosticism, you know, as it were, to be a much more satisfying, because it's more a search for knowledge, you know, to know these things, and that's actually true. I mean, I do want to know, and until I do know, I present these things as questions, you know, and I've always made special care to let people know that is that I'm interested in posing questions. To me, you know, an unanswered question is more valuable than a questionable answer. You know, that's sort of my motto. You know, people can, when speculation crosses over to dodgy answers, it's no longer interesting, because I think there's a process in the human brain that it feeds on questions, you know, that you're feeding your brain by constantly giving it interesting questions to ponder. And I think this is a part of, you know, certainly the Socratic method, but also the you know, the mystery traditions themselves. I think also a lot of the esoteric symbol systems like the Kabbalah and things like that. It's all about feeding the brain questions. And I think that that's something that we've really lost sight of. You know, that it is important to seek knowledge, But it is just as important to not feed our brains dodgy answers in lieu of convincing evidence, if that makes sense. I think that the process of questioning, it's part of our growth process, and I don't mean that in this sort of mushy, namby-pamby new age sense. I mean that like your brain literally grows when you feed it questions. Like I absolutely believe that. So when you ask me about like the serious symbolism, it's like I can point to you like the fact that the winter gardens, the palm-lined winter gardens, palms meaning phoenix, meaning rebirth, aligns with the monolith hotel.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.